This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
If you like true crime, dark history, the haunted, and paranormal, then we think you'll like Ghost Town.
Ghost Town is hosted by me, Rebecca Lieb.
And me, Jason Horton.
We cover both notorious and obscure true crimes.
The haunted, paranormal, and unexplained.
And the dark history of everything from world events to pop culture.
There are new episodes of Ghost Town every Wednesday and Friday.
Find out for yourself what Vulture.com called essential listening, and one listener called a total waste of time.
So pause the podcast you're listening to right now.
And go subscribe to Ghost Town for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And at ghosttownpod.com.
Warning. This episode contains details that some listeners may find disturbing. December 15th, 1927, Los Angeles, California. 12-year-old Marion Parker was kidnapped from school by a man calling himself Mr. Cooper. Within a few days, the entire city was on the hunt for this man because he committed the most brutal and heinous murder in the history of the city. This was not a kidnapping done for ransom money, which is how the ordeal started. This Mr. Cooper was much more dangerous. This is a study of strange. Welcome back to the show. Although today's episode is what I like to call a mini-sode because I don't have a guest, it is not a small story. This is a very profound case. This murder kidnapping was considered the worst crime in Los Angeles' history at the time. It involved a manhunt that went across borders. There were thousands of volunteers and investigators. There were huge monetary rewards to help. But this case has since been overshadowed by the Black Dahlia and some other Los Angeles crime. But to me, this story is the most terrifying. And it's an early example of someone using the guilty by insanity plea. So listen to the rest of the episode to hear how that actually plays out. So let's dive in to the murder of Marion Parker. Marion Parker was born on October 12th, 1915. Her parents were Perry and Geraldine Parker. Marion had a twin, her sister Marjorie, and one older sibling, a brother, Perry Jr. Perry, her father, worked at the National Trust and Savings Bank, and stories and anecdotes that came out about Marion say that she was very fun-loving, she was very close with her parents, she loved to go to work with her father, and she was seen around the bank quite often because of that. And she was also a bit of a tomboy, she loved to play outside, throw balls, play sports. Just a really fun-loving kid that had a lot of friends. And then when Marion was 12 years old, she was kidnapped. The day was December 15th, 1927. Marion and her sister Marjorie went to school, and the sisters would take the streetcar to and from their school, Mount Vernon High School, which is today Johnny Cochran Middle School, near the Lafayette Square neighborhood in Los Angeles. They were in the sixth grade, and honestly, this morning was just like any other normal day. They arrived at school and went to class. But then around noon, a dark Chrysler coupe pulled up out front of the school. A man exited the car, walked into Mount Vernon Junior High, and introduced himself as Mr. Cooper to the woman in the office, whose name was Mary Holt. And Mr. Cooper claimed that he worked with Mr. Perry Parker. And Perry Parker had been involved in a serious car accident, and he was requesting to see his daughter by his bedside. This is where things get a little awkward, because this man, Mr. Cooper, didn't know that there were two Parker daughters. So Mrs. Holt asked which daughter he meant, and the man stumbled and said, the younger one. Well, they're the same age. And when he was told that, he was like, the smaller one. Now, as awkward as this sounds, and as sus as my son would describe it as, apparently this gentleman came off as very sincere and even charming, and he even told Mary Holt that she should call the bank to verify, but she did not. Quick aside, if you're a regular listener, you know that I love to correct misconceptions about historical mysteries or fix inaccuracies that come about in the genre of sort of true crime and scary things that I cover. And in this case, you will hear some different versions of small details of this case. Some of these things I was unable to verify. And in those instances, I'm going to call them out. If you're a listener and you know this case really well and you can help me confirm some of these things, feel free to shoot me an email, astudyofstrange@gmail.com, because I want to learn and I want to get things right. So the first such detail that happens in this case is this man at the school, Mr. Cooper. Some accounts claim that he showed up and he asked for Marion by name. The sources I trust more so far say otherwise, and it played out the way I described it here, where he didn't know her name and he didn't know she had a sister. I also read a newspaper account that claimed that the man went up to Marion that morning before she got on the streetcar to go to school and tried to convince her to come with him, and she didn't do it. I don't believe that one, but I still wanted to share it because I did come across a newspaper article from the time that said that. Regardless of those things, Marion Parker was called. She went to the office of the school and she left with a complete stranger. After school, Marion's sister Marjorie went home. She informed the family that Marion had left with a man, and Marjorie had seen this man. I don't know how, but maybe it was through a window at the school or something, but she described this Mr. Cooper as a white man, probably like 25 to 30 years old, 5'8"-ish, with a slender, skinny build, dark hair, wavy hair. And soon, on the same day, the Parkers received a telegram. And it read, "To P.M. Parker, 1621 South Wilton Place, L.A., Marion secure, use good judgment, interference with my plans dangerous." And then it was signed, both Marion Parker and George Fox. The telegram was sent from Alhambra, which is just outside of LA, sort of towards the northeast from the city. The kidnapper sent a variety of letters and telegrams to the Parkers, and all of them are terrifying, strange, and one can only imagine what the family was going through in this moment. In one of the first letters, it was a registered letter, the kidnapper demanded $1,500 for Marion's safe return. To quote, "Secure 75 $20 gold certificates, $1,500. Keep them on your person. Go about your daily business as usual. Leave out the police and detectives. Make no public notice. Keep this affair private. Make no search. Fulfilling these terms with the transfer of the currency will secure the return of the girl. Failure to comply with these requests mean no one will ever see the girl again, except the angels in heaven. You will receive further notice." End quote. The top of the letter has "death" written out with the Greek alphabet, and then it's signed "fate" at the bottom. And it's worth noting that the handwriting changes in this letter from cursive to bold lettering, and it also gave Perry Parker 3 days to secure the money. Some of the correspondence the kidnapper would sign George Fox. Soon this became just the Fox. I'll also point out gold certificates. I wasn't aware of this, but they look and act like normal currency, like normal dollar bills. They were used until 1933. They're backed by gold reserves. And if you had a $20 gold certificate like this guy is asking for, it's like having a $20 bill. You can take that into stores, you can buy things with it. And they do have serial numbers, worth noting. And Perry Parker did gather $1,500 worth of gold certificates. And the police told Parker, do not pay this man. But on the 16th, just a day after Marion was kidnapped, Perry Parker was notified by the Fox to bring money and meet him. and Perry did so, but the kidnapper never showed up to the meeting place. The next day, a message arrived, and this letter stated that the kidnapper saw Perry being followed by the police, which he was, that was very true, and was told, "Do not do that again." An additional letter showed up that day from Marion. Her letter, I personally believe, and I think it's kind of obvious, was drafted by the kidnapper, like she was told what to write on the letter. And she says things like, "Father, this is your last chance. Please do what this man tells you. Otherwise, you know, I may not return, or this could be the end." And it's really, really heartbreaking. And then at 7:35 p.m., there's a phone call from the kidnapper. And Perry Parker was told to immediately come to the corner of 5th Street and Manhattan Place alone. The plan was this. The kidnapper would drive up beside Parker's car, show him that Marion was safe, take the ransom money, and then drop Marion off about a block away. And Perry follows these instructions to the T. He left home alone, no cops following him this time, with $1,500 and $20 gold certificates, and he shortly arrived at the meeting spot, which is 428 Manhattan Place. Then the dark Chrysler coupe pulled up beside Parker's car, with Marion sitting motionless in the front seat. The driver covers up his face with a white handkerchief. He's holding a sawed-off shotgun, and he said, "Your daughter's asleep," and demanded the money. Parker handed over the money, and then, per the plan, he followed this coupe about a block away to 432 Manhattan Place, where the car doors opened and Marion was essentially just thrown out or pushed out of the car. The Chrysler sped away. Perry ran up to his daughter, picked her up, and quickly realized she was dead. Perry did try to read the license plate of the Chrysler, but he only got a partial read before it was gone. Now, I give a warning at the top of the show, but I'm going to make a second warning here. It's not easy to share what happened to Marion Parker, so if you're squeamish, you may want to skip the next minute or two of the episode. When Parker picked up Marion, he quickly noticed she was dead because it wasn't her full body. She was mutilated. Marion's arms were cut off at the elbows. Her legs were similarly cut off at the knees. Her body was cut in half, and she was missing her internal organs because she had been disemboweled and they had been replaced with newspaper and rags. And there was a wire tied around her forehead that held her head up, and her eyelids had been sewn open so that she would look alive. This kidnapping was now a murder. Like other historical crimes I've covered, the press was all over this. Some sensationalism, as per usual, but it does seem to me that this case, being a child victim, fueled this desire from authorities and the public to investigate this as hard and as fast as they could. Thousands of police officers worked on it, and after Marion was found killed, they investigated every possible scenario, even considering the killer could be trying to drive south across the border into Mexico. The very next day, police found the Chrysler coupe, and the car was determined to have been stolen from Kansas City. Also that day, in Elysian Park, which is near Dodger Stadium today in downtown Los Angeles, were found 6 separate bundles of newspaper, which contained missing parts of Marion's body, her arms, legs, and organs. As I described at the top of the episode, this is a heinous crime, and the whole region was scared. They were on alert. Schools went on lockdown looking for strange men, and the community started raising money for a reward to help find this murderer. And the award went up to, I think it's just over $1 million in today's money. Some suspects were arrested, but they were quickly cleared of suspicion. But there were some clues. A towel in Marion's body had a label on it that identified it as coming from the Bellevue Arms Apartments, northwest of downtown in the Angelino Heights neighborhood. The manager of that apartment building claimed that the suspect was likely a gentleman who went by the name Donald Evans and had rented out room 315 the month prior. Donald Evans was not there anymore, but this is a big lead. Investigators found out that Mr. Cooper, aka Donald Evans, aka the Fox, was actually a man named William Edward Hickman. who had been arrested in June 1927 for attempting to cash forged checks worth around $400. Here's where I've read a couple of different things that I can't quite put the exact pieces on, so listeners, help me out if you can. One story claims that Hickman worked with Perry Parker at the bank. And this does seem to be true, that Hickman worked at the bank. But this first story here is that Hickman lost his job when he was caught forging a check. He returned to the bank later after serving probation and asked for his job back. But it was Perry Parker who said, no, we're not going to hire you, and denied him the job. The other story is that Hickman was arrested when Perry alerted authorities about fraud and forgeries, so that Perry Parker had been the one that actually caused Hickman to get arrested in the first place. There's a few other minor variations of this account that I've come across. In either scenario, it doesn't seem to affect the outcome of this case, but again, I'm trying to get things as right as I can. So if you know which scenario is true, please let me know. Long story short, this Hickman guy had it out for Perry Parker, and the kidnapping may have been partially motivated by revenge. After Hickman had been arrested for these forged checks, he moved back home to Kansas City, and this is where he stole the dark Chrysler, and he drove it all the way across the country again back to LA. Fingerprints in the apartment, in the car, on the letter, they all matched. They all matched Hickman. And his fingerprints had been on file because of that initial arrest with the forgery. But it soon found out that Marion Parker was not Hickman's first victim. Hickman was only 19 years old at the time. He had been raised in Arkansas, in Kansas City, and his family was very strict religious. And in 1926, Hickman had moved to the Los Angeles area and lived with a 16-year-old named Welby Hunt and Welby Hunt's grandparents. Hunt's grandfather soon died under mysterious circumstances after Hickman moved in. And Hunt and Hickman, in their spare time, decided to get into small-time robbery. And it was during this time, during a robbery, that they shot and killed a druggist named Clarence Ivy Thomas. Not even a full year later, Marion Parker would be mutilated and murdered. So now that authorities know who William Hickman is, they have his fingerprints, they know his name, they know what he looks like, they send out the word because they need to catch William Edward Hickman. And luckily, everybody was on the lookout for this guy. It was a huge story. The press is reporting all about it. His name and information on the case, all of it is shared. They even had the foresight to have the serial numbers from all the money that William Hickman had. Hickman had also stolen a green Hudson sedan. And on Wednesday, December 21st, in Seattle, Washington, a man went into a store, he purchased a hat, gloves, underwear, and he paid for them with a $20 gold certificate. The clerk recognized the serial number on the bill as one from the murder case, because these things had been being published in the newspapers. And so he calls the police. And then another of the marked $20 gold certificates was used to pay for gasoline at a garage in Kent, Washington. So the search is narrowing in. Hickman was finally arrested on Thursday, December 22nd, near Echo, Oregon, near the Washington border, after a two-mile car chase. Inside his car, the stolen green Hudson sedan, was a sawed-off shotgun, a .45 caliber handgun, as well as $1,400 remaining from the ransom money. When the police finally stopped him and he pulled over, Hickman surrendered quietly, saying, "Well, I guess it's all over." This was such big news that a billboard was built and put onto the spot where Hickman was arrested. And here's where things take a strange turn. William Hickman did not deny that he had taken part in the kidnapping of Marion Parker, but he did blame two brothers, Oliver and Frank Kramer, for actually killing the girl. A reporter from the East Oregonian was given a detailed account of the kidnapping and murder from Hickman. Hickman said that he was being nice to the girl. He took Marion to a movie, and the Kramers are the ones you want. They're the ones that took it too far. The Kramers, it turns out, they're not just some concoction that Hickman is creating in his own mind. They're real. However, they were incarcerated at the time of all of this. So Hickman's story quickly falls apart. Hickman ends up writing a 19-page confession admitting to the murder of Marion Parker, and he claims that he did all of this to get money to go to college to become a minister. And Marion was killed only after she recognized him because they had met or seen each other around the bank. William Edward Hickman went on trial in 1928, and he was one of the early users of the new not guilty by reason of insanity plea. But Hickman was known to start acting more strange while he was in prison. And some stories told by guards during the trial say that Hickman was asking them how can he behave more insane. But in court, through his attorney, Hickman said that he was guided by a supernatural entity, a supernatural godlike power called Providence. However, the district attorney was having none of this, and a psychiatrist argued that Hickman was sane and in control of his thoughts and actions. The trial ended on the 9th of February, 1928, and the jury only needed half an hour to find Hickman guilty. He was hanged at St. Quentin Prison in October of that year. It took him almost 2 minutes to die, as it was later found that his neck didn't break during the hanging, and he asphyxiated to death. This case of Marion Parker's has inspired songs. Ayn Rand was actually using this story as inspiration for a book, which I don't think she finished. Apparently, she was turning Hickman into a bit of a misunderstood hero, at least as far as what I've read about this. I haven't actually read what she wrote. And William Hickman, he was a petrifyingly bad person. He showed no empathy, no remorse for anything he had ever done. And he showed signs that he really liked the attention that he was getting after the murder. And he apparently even mentioned that he looked up to Leopold and Loeb, that story, and the amount of attention that those two received. And it's my own personal opinion, but though he asked for money and received a ransom, I'm not sure money was his primary motivation. When you read the letters and the telegrams, the way his sentence structure changes the handwriting, yes, he is trying to hide his identity, but part of me thinks that he enjoyed this process. And how he ended up mutilating Marion, which he allegedly did in his bathroom, there's more evil to this guy than just wanting money or just getting revenge on Perry Parker. This thinking of mine may be kind of obvious. I don't think I'm alone in thinking this, but I definitely just wanted to share my own perspective on it. We also have to remember the families associated with true crime cases, and the Parker family had to live with this somehow. I really hope they were able to find some peace as time went on, and hopefully the quick arrest and the conviction of Hickman helped in that, though I'm not sure it did, and I don't think they really talked publicly about this in the years following. As I stated earlier, this was a huge case. It shocked the whole country, especially the West Coast. And I don't normally share tales that have been solved on this show. You know, I like to dive into the unsolved, the strange, and the mysterious. But I also like to bring attention to cases that I think get lost. A lot of shows have covered the Marion Parker murder. You do come across it, so it's not like it's completely forgotten. But it was overshadowed by other huge stories like the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, and then eventually World War II and the Black Dahlia. But that'll do it for the murder of Marion Parker. Thank you for listening to A Study of Strange. If you're new to the show, take a quick second to hit that subscribe or follow button. Leave a rating and review if you can. That goes a long way to helping others find our show. If you're looking for other ways to support the show or get additional content, check out our Substack. You'll find that through the support tab on our website, astudyofstrange.com. Thank you and good night.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.